In John chapter 4, Jesus describes the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. Verses 23 and 24. Yet a time is coming and has now come when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and in truth. Now for the next few minutes, stay tuned to Worship in Spirit and Truth with Pastor Jeff Scoggin.
Okay, here it is.
Revelation 12. A great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his heads. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth, and his angels with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ. For the accuser of our brothers, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been hurled down. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury because he knows that his time is short. When the dragon saw that he had been hurled to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. The woman was given the 2 wings of a great eagle so that she might fly to the place prepared for her in the desert, where she would be taken care of for a time, times and half a time, out of the serpent's reach. Then from his mouth the serpent spewed water like a river to overtake the woman and sweep her away with the torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring, those who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus.
In Revelation chapter 10, which we just looked at, we're seeing the first of 3 groups that are going to be identified by the time that we're done. It's one of the groups that are going to be involved in the Battle of Armageddon, and that is God's people. We're going to see in Revelation chapter 12 an overview of Christian history, a sequence of events with cosmic implications. We have to pay close attention because it's not just in sequential order, which is typical for Revelation. The first 2 stages that we're going to see for us are history. They're already past. The third stage will be sometime in the near future. Now, there is a system in Revelation that we need to understand, and that is each time that we see a new character introduced for the first time in Revelation, John gave us a description of that character to help us identify the character. For instance, when Jesus is first introduced in Revelation chapter 1, he describes Jesus, you know, walking among the 7 lampstands, dressed in a robe to his feet, golden sash, white hair, eyes like fire, feet like glowing bronze, and so on. He pauses in the story to describe what this character looks like because it's the first time that we've seen him. After that, though, any time that we see Jesus, whenever Jesus is depicted, even if he's called by another name or a symbol like lamb or lion or rider on the horse and things like that, John doesn't go to great lengths to re-describe him because he's already done that once. We've already seen this character. A cursory reading of Revelation makes it seem like there are a lot of characters in Revelation. Easy to get them. It's like a Russian novel. It's easy to just get them all confused because there's so many different characters. But the fact is that there are really only a few characters in Revelation, but they are known by different names and symbolized by different symbols. Each character is introduced and described only once. So if a new character appears on the scene, it seems like a new character, but it's not described, then we know that we've seen this character before, but under a different name or represented by a different symbol. So let's read Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 through 6 again. A great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his heads. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth so that he could devour the child the moment it was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. So John saw a woman in the heavens who was also pregnant. Also in the heavens was a great red dragon who was obviously the enemy of the woman and the child that she was about to bear. The dragon was prepared to devour the child as soon as it was born. A male child was born, but the child was caught up to God and to his throne. So we have three characters in play. First is a woman, who most scholars agree was or is in some form or another the people of God. Now some say it's specifically Israel, some say it's Eve, some say it's Mary, some say it's the Christian church, but most everyone agrees that at least in some sense the woman represents the people of God. To be honest, I can't see the Eve or Mary scenario very well though, because first of all we're using symbols. And in verse 6, the woman symbolically flees to the desert for an amount of time that turns out to be longer than a person's lifetime. So that doesn't really work out. That rules out one specific person. And in fact, I can't think of anywhere in Revelation where a symbol represents a specific person. When a specific person is part of the story of Revelation, that person is literally portrayed, like Jesus in Revelation 1. Jesus doesn't represent someone, he's Jesus. So the woman is a symbol of the people of God in some sense anyway. The second character is an enormous red dragon whose identity is given outright in verse 9. The great red dragon is the devil or Satan. So we know who that one is. The third character is the male child. And again, everyone agrees pretty much that the child was Jesus because he's the one that was to rule with the iron scepter, which is what Jesus is doing in Revelation 19:15. So we know who these characters are. So considering the big picture, it makes the most sense here to understand the woman who gives birth to Jesus as the Old Testament people of God in general, Israel as a nation, rather than just Eve or just Mary. Later in Revelation 17, a woman once again represents a group of people. So this is consistent with the way that symbols are used in Revelation. So Herod, and later the Jewish leaders and Rome, using those as his tools, Satan attempts to destroy Jesus on multiple occasions. But Jesus ends up being snatched up after the crucifixion, being snatched up to heaven and to God's throne. But the woman goes out into the desert. And we saw that yesterday, how Israel, in the person of Jesus, went out into the desert. By this time, Jesus, with his church, an earlier class, had become the new Israel. So the woman still represents the people of God. The symbol remains consistent, even though the name or the form is slightly different in the form of the Christian church. So the woman of Revelation 12 begins by representing the people of God in the form of Old Testament Israel. She later still represents the people of God in the form of the Christian church. So God's people are a constant, though the form in which they exist changes. So the child is caught up to God and to the woman, and the woman flees to the wilderness. Where does the dragon go? Do you see that? Where did the dragon go? Apparently the dragon goes to heaven as well as the child. Because in the very next scene, we see the dragon at war with Michael. Here it is. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth and his angels with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, "Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ, for the accuser of our brothers who accuses them before our God day and night has been hurled down. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. Therefore, rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them, but woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury, because he knows his time is short." Now notice that Michael is not introduced or explained. Neither is the male child, for that matter. So what does that tell us? We've seen these characters before somewhere. We've already met Michael. We know who he is. He's already been described. Same with the child. The information we have here is that he, Michael, is in heaven battling Satan, and the only character that we have met in Revelation who could be in heaven and could be fighting Satan is who? Jesus himself. That's right. So Michael, the male child, and Jesus, they're all names for the same character. Now, please don't stall on this idea that Michael and Jesus are the same person. It does give us pause. Because elsewhere in Scripture, Michael is referred to as an angel. Now, does that mean that we think God is a created being that's not quite on the same level as God? No, not at all. The word angel, the way that they understood it back in John's day, is different than the way we typically use it today. The word angel, we use the word angel to describe a kind of being. Whereas back then, they used the word angel to describe a function, a job. Something that a person or something was doing. The word angel simply means messenger. So if someone is bringing his own message rather than sending a different messenger, then he's his own messenger. He's his own angel. It's a job title, a description. So to equate Jesus with an angel is not to make him any less divine at all. It is not to relegate him to the status of a created being. It's simply describing what he happens to be doing at the moment. That's all. Delivering a message in person as his own messenger. And if you want to confirm this, and we won't check it right now, but go to the story of Moses in the burning bush. Okay, we all know that it was God in the burning bush because God said, "Moses, take off your shoes. You're standing on holy ground." Angels didn't say that. Only God said that. And it describes God there as the angel of the Lord. He's bringing his own message. That's okay. Doesn't change anything. So, the dragon follows the male child to heaven, war ensues there, Michael is victorious, the dragon is cast back down to earth, and the loud voice says, "Woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has come down to you." Now, do you see the sequence so far? First, there's war in heaven, Revelation 12, 1-4. Then there's war on earth, when the dragon attacks the male child and the woman flees to the desert. That's verses 4 and 6. The child goes to heaven in verse 5. Then there is war in heaven, again with Michael, and those are verses 7 through 9. And then finally, there's war on earth again, verses 12 through 17. Now, I always get questions here, so let me try to explain it now. It seems that these wars must have looked different. I don't know. I do not know what physical war in heaven would look like. I'm not sure how to imagine that. What did it mean when Satan, there was war in heaven and Satan and his angels were thrown out? I don't know what that looks like. But Satan and his angels and his followers were cast out of heaven the first time physically in the first war, at least as physically as spirits can be. I don't know how that works. But he was cast out physically the first time, back when before he tempted Adam and Eve. Okay, he was cast out physically that time. The war on earth was sort of physical as well, as Satan and his angels attacked Jesus and God's people with physical violence. Okay, so that war in many ways was also physical. The next war in heaven, though, seems to have been more of a spiritual war. Evidently, Before the cross, Satan still had some access to heaven. We think of the story of Job, remember? The sons of God came together and Satan came and joined them. And God said to Satan, "Where have you been?" He said, "I've been going back to and fro on the earth." Apparently, Satan still had access to heaven to some point. At the cross, though, Satan was cast out of heaven spiritually as well. At that point, he no longer had access to anywhere but planet Earth. Planet Earth was put into quarantine. Satan was not going to be allowed to go anywhere else and spread his cancer throughout the universe. So, in other words, at the cross, the war was officially over. In other words, it was won. That didn't mean that battle skirmishes aren't still happening. We know very well they are. But case was closed. Jesus finished it at the cross. The war was won. But the final war on earth is also more of a spiritual war. Even though the conclusion is foregone, Satan knows that he's lost. He continues to fight, you know, like guerrilla warfare. Even though it's gone, he continues to fight. So the war continues even though he has lost. And this war is also more of a spiritual war than it is a physical war. In the past, in the last war on earth, Satan was fighting physically against God's people with persecution and with destruction of Jesus and his people, or attempting that. At the end, the next war is going to be more deception-based. Okay, will there be violence and such? Well, yeah, probably. But it's more deception-based. There's more spiritual going on. So note that the dragon plays a part in each of the four attacks, which seems to be strong evidence that this is a sequence of history going on here, because the dragon keeps appearing at different and successive times that have to be in sequence. So with that background of the original war in heaven in the beginning of Earth's history, then we see stage one of Christian history. Stage one of Christian history began with Jesus, his birth, the cross, his ascension, his enthronement with the Father. That's where Christian history begins, right? There was no Christians before that. There were no Christians before that. So Christian history has its beginnings there. We call that stage one. Now, before going to stage two of Christian history, there is a gospel interlude in verse 11. Okay, there's something in the middle of all this, which is very important. It almost seems like an aside. We're tempted to skip over it, but it's incredibly important stuff. John does this frequently, especially as we get into the really heavy, scary stuff that we see in Revelation. It's like John pauses to remind us who's in control of all this so we can keep perspective. Don't worry about what we're seeing here. As awful as it is, we know who's won the war. It's done. God has finished it. Relax. It's okay. So here's a brief gospel interlude in chapter 12. Remember, it's prophecy in combination with the gospel, right? So here it is. Verse 11. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. The word overcome is one of the most important words in all of Revelation. You see it everywhere, and in nearly every case it refers either to Jesus Christ or to his people. There are a few instances where it is attributed to the beast power, but those are counterfeit situations, which we'll see later. In this case, it refers to God's people. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. How did they overcome? First one, by the blood of the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. Remember John the Baptist said this about Jesus? It's an obvious reference to the cross, to Jesus on the cross. It's because of Jesus' death that we have any hope of overcoming, right? But the question is how does the cross make a difference in overcoming? Now, we understand how the cross makes a difference in forgiveness of sin. We've got that part. We understand. Jesus paid the penalty for us. But how does the cross make a difference in overcoming sin? It's kind of like saying someone paid my debt, and the way he paid it will stop me from ever getting in debt again. You know, how does that work? I like the idea, but how does it work? There are a couple of ways that the cross helps us to overcome day by day. First of all, the cross identifies sin in a gut-wrenching way. Satan apparently has leveled some pretty awful accusations against God and His system of government. He's questioned whether or not God is really a God of love and freedom. And apparently, the devil was convincing enough that he managed to suck into his lies a full third of the population of heaven. Now, I don't know what the population of heaven is, but we know that it's at least 10,000 times 10,000, right? Isn't that one of the scenes we see at the second coming? What is that, a billion, I think? So let's just say for fun that the population of heaven was a billion. He convinced a third, and we're talking perfect beings. We're not talking sinful, fallen human beings, gullible like we are. We're talking perfect beings. He caused them to question God when they could see God. That's kind of scary. He is good at deception. So Satan managed to convince them to follow him. And among those who did not follow him, there must have been questions that remained. If he was convincing enough to convince a third, there must have been questions that remained. Could Satan have had a point? So God, in his infinite wisdom, allowed Satan to make his case to see if maybe evil might be better than love. So everyone could see whether if sin might be better than obedience. The universe had to see the end result of Satan's system of government, and they saw it at the cross. If the end result of sin would cruelly crucify the most gentle, kind, loving being in the whole universe, who gave himself up voluntarily, no less, if sin could do that, then sin is as awful as it gets. The cross reveals sin for what it really is underneath. It's false advertising. That's what it is, isn't it? Sin promises all sorts of good things. It doesn't tell us the small print. Another thing that the cross does and is to enable us to overcome is it proves our value. How much of sin do you think is a result of undervaluing ourselves? I mean, think about this. We see it from childhood, the way that we put each other down in order to build ourselves up. It's called bullying, right? I mean, we do that, kids do that all the time, and so do grown-ups, frankly. We humans, we kill each other in order to prove that we should be on top. We fight to be first, best, most valuable player. We steal to get the things that we want. Things that make us more valuable in other people's eyes. The underlying cause of sin may well be a misunderstanding of how valuable we actually are, because if we understood how valuable we really are, we wouldn't spend our lives trying to prove it to everybody. And to ourselves. So how valuable are you? Anybody want to venture a guess? I've heard it said that if we were boiled down to our chemical components, we'd be worth about $12. Give or take, depending on your size. But really, we're not valued in terms of our physical worth, right? We're valued in terms of the value that we have in the eyes of other people. And that is, that, you know, to not understand your own value, to look to other people for your value, you're looking in the wrong place for your value. That is a terrible place to look for your value. But to look in one place for your value is the most incredible thing if you're looking in the right place. The fact of the matter is that the most valuable being in the entire universe valued you so much that he gave up more than we could ever comprehend in order to save us from certain death. Why did he do it? One reason. Because he loves you. Because he values you. Still, we've heard that so often, I don't think it computes. I don't think it has the impact that it should. It would probably do more for our feeling of self-worth to learn that, you know, some important person, the president or somebody, was coming to see us to ask our advice on some matter of state. Wow! You know, that would make us feel really pretty important. But we've heard about Jesus so much that it doesn't compute that the King of the universe didn't just come to visit us. He came to die for you. It also doesn't compute because we don't even realize how valuable Jesus is. That doesn't compute either. How valuable is Jesus? Well, he's the creator, right? Which is more valuable, Monet himself or one of his paintings? Obviously the man himself, because he can always create another painting, can't he? Jesus created everything. That means he is more valuable than everything. Everything in the entire universe, all the gold and the diamonds in the world combined, Jesus is worth more than that. He's more valuable than our entire solar system and the entire universe, no matter what fabulous riches they found. I just heard, what was it, NPR or something, they just found an entire diamond planet. What's the biggest diamond on here on Earth? You know, something like that. They just found a diamond planet. Jesus is more valuable than whatever riches you could imagine might be out in the universe somewhere. It is no overstatement to say that Jesus is everything. Value. And He valued you so much that He stopped everything. He came down to this dark, disgusting planet to live a life of pain and die a cruel death because He thinks you are worth it. He thinks you are valuable. That makes you as valuable as Jesus Christ Himself. Isn't that true? Because Jesus gave His most valuable life in exchange for yours. Wow. Don't look anywhere else for your value. Don't look to your family. Don't look to your job. Don't look to your friends. Don't look to who you know or what you have. Look only to Jesus on the cross and realize who He is and why He hung there. That's why the cross makes it possible for you and me to overcome. Because the cross jerks away the very thing that drives us to sin, the search for our value. You are a child of the King of the universe, and He loves you more than any child you have ever loved. And He values you more than His own life. He thinks you are the coolest, most awesome friend to have. Understanding that should change the way that we see ourselves and the way that we show ourselves valuable. The only approval we should ever be concerned about is His. That's it. Okay, the second way God's people overcome in Revelation 12:11 is by the word of their testimony. Word of their testimony. What is the word of someone's testimony? It's not really that cryptic. We still use the term sometimes in church. Share your testimony, right? Share what Jesus has done in your life. As odd as it may sound, an integral part of overcoming evil is sharing your testimony. If you are struggling with sin, listen to this. And we all are, right? Listen to this. Sharing your faith is one of the ways that you overcome sin. Any idea why that might be? Expressing your faith to another person always affects your own faith. Always affects your own faith. Head knowledge of the cross is a different thing than heart knowledge of the cross. And sharing your faith moves what's in your head to your heart. It's really true. When you're sharing your faith, there's actually at least two people listening. The person you're talking to you to, and yourself. You're hearing yourself. Talk garbage, we'll have more garbage. Talk faith, you're going to have more faith. The third stage of overcoming in Revelation 12:11 is losing our fear of death. How would you like that? How would you like to lose your fear of death? Is it really possible to not fear death? Have you ever heard of the Christian reformer by the name of John Huss? He got crosswise with the Christian church back in the 1400s, I think, and for his trouble, they put him on top of a pile of dry sticks and papers and set it on fire. And as they kindled the fire around his feet, his final words were this, listen. In the truth of the gospel which I have written, taught, and preached, I will die today with gladness. No fear. No fear of death. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. We have trouble when people laugh at us or think we're strange. They overcome him by the word of the Lamb and the blood of the Lamb and the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as shrink from death. That's one sentence. It sounds like two separate thoughts, but it's one sentence. The result of overcoming by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony is that we will lose our fear of death. That's a promise. That is a guarantee. We will lose our fear of death. That's how the Christian martyrs were able to stand strong. If death was the only alternative to losing Jesus, or to not obeying Jesus, or to not be with Jesus, then so be it. Life without Jesus was not even an option to be considered. We can overcome Satan just as Jesus did, but we do it by claiming His blood as our salvation, by sharing our faith in Him with other people, and by staying in that mode of operation until we become more willing to die than give Him up. Amen? So that's the gospel interlude in the middle of this sequence of history. The gospel in combination with prophecy. Powerful verse. Okay, Father in heaven, we invite Your Spirit once again to guide our thoughts as we look into Your Word. Give us understanding, give us wisdom. In Jesus' name, amen. Okay, Revelation chapter 12. We've looked at stage 1, which is the time of Jesus and His disciples. Next, we're going to look at stage 2, which is the central period of persecution, Middle Ages and beyond, during the 2300 days. And after that, we're going to look into stage 3, which is the time of the end. Okay, so here's stage 2. Revelation 12:6. The woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. Now skip to verse 14. It's going to say kind of the same thing. The woman was given the two wings of a great eagle so that she might fly to a place prepared for her in the desert where she would be taken care of for a time, times and half a time, out of the serpent's reach. Then, from his mouth, the serpent spewed water like a river to overtake the woman and sweep her away with the torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of its mouth. So verse 6 and 14 are a lot the same. The story of God's people that began in verse 6 resumes again in verse 14. The language is almost the same, except that in verse 6 the number is 1,260 days. In verse 14 it's time, times, and half a time. Now that phrase, time, times, and half a time, it's an unusual phrase, which is nowhere used nowhere else in the Bible except in Daniel. So right away, we know again that John is building on the visions of Daniel in this passage. By now, we're not surprised by that at all. Now, this particular span of time is obviously significant because it's mentioned several times in Revelation. Twice, it's mentioned as 42 months, which breaks down to 1,260 days by their calendar. So 42 months and 1,260 days, same time period. However, in both cases, that time is stated as 42 months, it's on the negative side of Revelation's agenda. Okay, bad things are happening to God's people during this time. In Revelation 11:2, it's the time of the period that the Gentiles trample the holy city. Another time, it's when the beast wars against the saints. Both of them negative times. The two times that the time period is stated 1,260 days is on the positive side. Good things are happening to God's people. Revelation 11, the two witnesses prophesying. They're good guys. Revelation 12:6, when the woman, God's people, is cared for in the desert for that amount of time. But here in Revelation 12:14, the time is stated as time, times, and half a time. Just like in Daniel. So is this the same time period as 42 months and 1,260 days? Well, it's widely accepted based on the language that a time is a year. And that phrase is more accurately translated, a time, two times and half a time. In other words, a year, 2 years, and half a year. How many years is that? Three and a half. 3.5 years. So that much, anyway, is pretty well accepted by scholars across the board. Your Bible might even note that in the margin. It's mine does. However, the disagreement comes when some assert that the 3.5 years are literal years, and others say, no, they are symbolic, prophetic years. Now, you already know that I fall soundly on the side of symbolism because of what we read in the very first verse of Revelation about signifying. So anytime that we wonder if possibly we should switch from symbolic to literal, we've got the burden of proof lies on the literal. We have to make a really good case that we should switch to that. And I can't see much of a case for switching to literal time here. Not to mention the fact that I can hardly convince myself that it is coincidental that 3.5 years just happens to be 42 months, 1,260 days by the prophetic calendar. That would strike me as a pretty far-fetched coincidence. What strengthens this idea more is that the description of the beast in Revelation 13 and the little horn power in Daniel 7, the little horn power is blaspheming against God. It's making war against the saints for a time, times, and half a time. In Revelation 13, the beast is, guess what? Blaspheming God, making war against the saints for 42 months. Knowing the way that prophecy uses different symbols to describe the same characters, could it be that the little horn power of Daniel 7 and the beast of Revelation 13 could be describing the same thing in the same time frame? We'll get more deeply into that when we get to Revelation 13, but in a nutshell, yes. So it seems solid to me that 42 months, 1260 days, and a time times and half a time all refer to the same time period, which fits the overall plot of Revelation, and that's where we're headed. The big story. So there's too much evidence to support this. Now, we gain some valuable clues from these time span texts that we're going to need as we move into the next chapter of Revelation. First, we see from Revelation 11:3 that the two witnesses are living in obscurity during the 1260-day time period. Now, most people agree that the two witnesses are good guys. They probably represent the Bible itself, the Old and New Testament. Scholars still call them the witnesses. You know, that's not unusual. The law and the prophets. Some people say the true people of God. Either way, we see that during this time, the two witnesses are living in obscurity. And so this is one valuable clue we're going to need. Tuck that one up your sleeve for later. We also gain another clue from the 42-month time period in Revelation 13:5 when we see that the saints are persecuted by a great power. When we combine these with the prophecies of Daniel, which we're going to do in a minute, we begin to see that this great power arises out of the kingdoms that Daniel saw in his visions. And that leads us to a critically important understanding, and that is this. The 1260 days and 42 months and 3.5 years, they can't be literal time periods. The evidence calls for a much greater span of time. So understanding the reality of the length of these time periods is crucial, because it's going to lead us to the identification of the symbols in Revelation, including the beast, who it is. Some interpretations of Revelation, they attempt to work within the boundaries of a literal 1,260 days. But again, the burden of proof lies with the one proposing the literal interpretation. I was getting ready to preach a sermon in Russia one time, and I don't speak Russian, so I had to have a translator. So I asked my translator, how long do I speak? How long should I speak? And he asked in Russian the pastor of the church where I was going to be, and the answer came back, 1 hour. Okay, I can do that, no, not a problem. And then all of a sudden the pastor said something else in Russian, and my translator started laughing. I said, what? And, you know, because I didn't get it. He said, what? He said, not prophetic time. And I laughed then too, because I knew exactly what he meant. Many believe in what is known as the year for a day principle. In other words, when prophecy talks about a day, it's a symbol for a year. Have you ever heard of that before? Okay. Now, to be fair, the Bible doesn't explicitly state this as a fact, but like we talked about before, the Bible doesn't explicitly talk about a lot of things, like whether I should eat a case of Twinkies, right? So, what the Bible does do is it provides general guiding principles that make it really quite clear of the way that we should understand a specific question. That's probably the best way to proceed with this idea, that in prophecy a day represents a year. We already saw that a time times and half a time represents the same time period. And in Daniel chapter, what is it, where Nebuchadnezzar, is it Daniel chapter 4, where Nebuchadnezzar is out and the beast is afield till 7 times pass over him? That's a year, right? So we can start with the Bible, first of all, to show that the Hebrews already had a mindset for this year for day principle. They called it the sabbatical year. This was common for them. Weeks of days, weeks of years, 7-year cycle that corresponded to the 7-day cycle, in which the 7th year was a year of rest for the land, just like the 7th day is a day of rest for the week. Leviticus and Chronicles both talk about this sabbatical year. There are a few examples of how Israel worked within this day for a year principle. After God brought Israel out of slavery, this is in Numbers chapter 14, he took them to the border of the land he promised them, remember? They sent spies across the land, they searched out the land for 40 days, came back, and they gave a bad report, and they said, we'd rather stay in the wilderness. And God said, okay, deal. You get to stay in the wilderness. You get to stay a year for every day. Okay? And to the Hebrews, that made sense. They understood that. Then in Ezekiel, God tells Ezekiel to lie on his side for 390 days, a day for each year of Israel's rebellion. There, outside of the Bible, there was the ruler Hammurabi. Have you heard of him before? Mesopotamia. He declared a 30-day celebration, one day for every year of his reign. That's the mindset back then. It worked that way. The Jews at Qumran used the same principle, taking 7-year periods. They called them weeks. So, and here's the clincher for me. Daniel chapter 9, there's a 70-week prophecy, which is 490 days. That takes us from Persia in the 6th century B.C. to the time of Christ. It's 490 years, not 490 days. Interestingly, all scholars accept the year-for-a-day principle in that spot. I get the feeling that someone's defending a specific agenda when they will apply the year for a day principle in one spot because the evidence requires it, and they refuse to apply it in another spot even though the evidence requires it. You know? Anyway, so in the grand scheme of prophecy, the day for a year principle makes sense. So that brings up the next question. When do you apply the year for a day principle? Whenever it's convenient? You know, when you want to? No, I'm pretty uncomfortable with that idea. We should consider the year for day principle in two situations. First, when we run into unusual numbers. I remember when my son hit 3.5 years old, I have bad pastor jokes, I know. And they said, how old is your boy? And I said, 1,260 days. Huh? Or 42 months, you know? Or better yet, a time times and half a time, you know? And it's an unusual way to state the number 3.5 years. Why would you do that? Well, because it's a symbol. It's an unusual way. He's calling attention to it. I'm stating this in a silly way because you need to understand something else is going on here. So unusual numbers in prophecy seem to be good candidates for being symbolic. Second situation, okay, unusual numbers, the second situation in which we should consider a day for year principle is when the time spans seem to require it. The fact is that a year a day for a principle is required, is necessary to balance these long, long, long range prophecies because they were long term kingdoms. Look at this. Daniel's prophecies, he sees 4 animals. Do you remember this? Each one was represented a kingdom that was to come. The first was Babylon, the lion, which ruled for 66 years. Then there was Medo-Persia, the bear, which ruled for 207 years. Then came Greece, the leopard, ruled for 163 years. Finally came Rome, the biggest and the strongest and the cruelest kingdom, which ruled for well over 500 years. Total, we're talking 1,000 years or so worth of kingdoms ruling the earth. Long-range prophecy here. Then, out of that last kingdom of Rome comes the mysterious little horn speaking great things against God. Now the beast itself was fearful enough, Rome, but Daniel focuses in, he zooms in on the little horn because to him that's the truly terrifying part. And this little horn power rules for a time, times, and half a time. Now, considering that we had spanned a huge span of time where God's people were persecuted under all of them and in the most inventive ways that people could come up with, especially Rome, can it really make sense that the most terrifying little horn only reigns for 3.5 literal years? I mean, he couldn't be more cruel than everybody else had been already. The only way to have been worse to the people of God was the time period in which they suffered. Literal 3.5 years just doesn't even make sense in the overall scheme of the story. So considering that the time period is mentioned, number one, in an unusual way, and that it doesn't make sense in the story in a literal interpretation, we realize that we should at least test it out by studying more deeply with the year and day, year for a day principle. And when we do that, we eventually discover that in Daniel's vision, the little horn power actually bridges the entire time from ancient Rome to the time of the end. It's a long time. 1,260 literal days isn't going to cut it. We're going to flesh this out more when we get into Revelation 13, we start looking at the beast. So again, the two times we consider these are unusual numbers and sensible time frames. All right, let's go on to the second stage of Christian history. The woman has been carried to the wilderness for 1,260 days, which we now see as 1,260 years, prophetic years. And that's where we left off, verse 15 of Revelation chapter 12. Then from his mouth the serpent spewed water like a river to overtake the woman and sweep her away with a torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of its mouth. So during the 1,260 years, that's what the dragon, the serpent, was up to. That's what he was doing. The serpent spewed out of his mouth. Now most people see this as representing the persecution of God's people, which it is. It's an obvious attack. But does your Bible have cross-references in it, including the margins? Mine does. And in there, you're going to see a little cross-reference number, probably, cross-referencing this phrase with Genesis chapter 3, verse 1. And that is a correct reference. And it's an allusion, strong allusion. Anybody know off the top of your head what the story in Genesis chapter 3, verse 1 is? It's the story of the serpent in the Garden of Eden. He's deceiving Eve. He's telling her lies. At this point in Revelation, John clearly intends for us to recall this story in order for us to interpret what he's intending us to understand of what the serpent is doing in spewing out this water. Throughout history, Satan has persecuted God's people. But persecution isn't the only way that Satan works. He uses deception also. He lies to us. Jesus called him the father of lies. He's a master illusionist, a great deceiver. When it comes to determining what he's up to, we cannot trust what we see and hear. Right? Any more than we can trust what we see at a David Copperfield magic show, right? You don't trust what you see there. You know better. Satan is better at deception than every magician and illusionist that has ever lived on earth combined. So if that doesn't make us pause for a minute, it should. We're up against a fearful enemy. Remember Jesus' words concerning the end of time in Matthew 24:24? For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect, if that were possible. What's going on here? Deception. Lies. By the time that we're done with this class, you are going to begin to see the frightening nature of the final great deception that the serpent has in store. It's laid out in these chapters that we're going through. For now, though, let's finish this section. The serpent here sent deception. He spewed water out of his head. He sent deception and persecution to try to destroy the woman, God's people. Now, we know what the persecution of God's people looks like from history. People being burned at the stake for their faith and so on. What would deception look like in history? What would deception look like? How about false doctrine, false religion, misrepresenting God? Isn't that what Satan does? Of course, that's exactly what Satan does. That fits the bill for deceiving God's people. Definitely something to consider. Satan deceived perfect heavenly angels concerning what they should believe about God. Satan deceived Eve concerning what she believed about God. Satan continues to deceive us in exactly the same way today. Knowing that people are drawn to religion, Satan knows that he has to turn people away from true religion where they might actually find God, or they will actually find God. So he introduces false religion. People want religion? Fine. He introduces false religion where they won't find God. If that's not what spiritual deception looks like, you got me what it does look like. It is. Verse 16, but the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of its mouth. Now the earth is one of those symbols in Revelation that is a positive force in one place. It's a negative force in another place. But here, the earth helps the people of God. Does a good thing by swallowing the river that comes to destroy them. Now, if the river is persecution and deception and false religion, then the earth must be something that provides for God's people a place of refuge away from the persecution and false religion, right? Whatever that might be, it's got to be something along those lines. So here, the earth is a positive thing. Later, we're going to see how earth isn't so positive. We also detect in these two verses an allusion to Israel's Exodus. Look at this one. You stretched out your right hand, and the earth swallowed them. This is a song of Moses and Israel right after their miraculous deliverance through the Red Sea. It refers to the Egyptian army, Israel saying, you stretched out your right hand, and the earth swallowed them. Just like in Exodus, God provided for his people a place of refuge. For 1,260 years of terrible times, persecution for God's people during the Middle Ages. Persecution and false religion threatened to destroy them. God provided safety and preservation. Okay, so that is stage two of Christian history, a period of persecution. Now we move to stage three, the time in history which we're now hurtling toward, the final conflict. Here's the next verse, Revelation 12:17. This is one of those duodirectional verses. Points forward and backward, we talked about. Here it is. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring, those who obey God's commandments and have the testimony of Jesus. I put have in brackets because it's better translated have the testimony of Jesus. The dragon was angry. He was enraged. He has repeatedly failed First, the male child escaped him. He wasn't strong enough to win the war in heaven. The woman escapes him into the desert. So this is the end for him. He knows this is his last chance. Every time that he has made a frontal assault upon God, he has failed. So he goes away from battling God, where he's always losing, and he goes to make war against the children of the woman who has escaped him. The children of the woman are described as those who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus, which we've already seen from previous classes that are God's last day people. So the battle lines are clearly drawn here. The dragon versus God's last day people in a final great battle. He's making war. But the dragon doesn't make a frontal assault this time. He goes, in Revelation chapter 13, he goes to the beach in search of a couple of allies. He knows there's a couple of characters there who are going to assist him. So the dragon goes to sea. He calls up two beasts. One arises from the sea, the other from the land. Now there are three of them. A trinity, if you will, just like there are three of God. A trinity. Merely coincidence? Maybe. We'll see. It's not. Revelation 12:17 sets the stage for the battle that the next two chapters are going to flesh out. The battle has two sides. The dragon side is going to be unpacked in Revelation chapter 13. The side of God and his people are going to be unpacked in Revelation chapter 14. So there you have Revelation chapter 12 and the three stages of the Christian church throughout history. At the beginning, we see the male child enthroned. That's the time of Jesus and his disciples. Stage one. At the other end, the final conflict, we see the dragon attacking the woman's children who are faithful to the commandments and have the testimony of Jesus. And spanning the time between Jesus and the time of the end is the 1260 years that the dragon attacks the woman. So that's the pattern of Revelation chapter 12 as a whole. That's the story of Revelation chapter 12. Revelation 12:17 has set the stage for the battle to come. It is the Battle of Armageddon. Battle of Armageddon isn't mentioned by name until chapter 16, but we are getting the first parts of it in chapter 13 and 14. So we're beginning even that next Saturday. All right? Let's run through the study guide quickly. Revelation chapter 12 is a prophetic overview of Christian history. Each time a new character is introduced in Revelation, John takes a moment to describe that character. Number three, if what seems like a new character appears in the story without a description, that's a clue that we've probably seen this character before under a different name or a different symbol. Number four, it seems like Revelation has many characters, but really there are only a few characters represented by different names and symbols. Number five, the woman of Revelation 12 represents the people of God in some form. Number six, the red dragon is Satan, the male child is Jesus. Number seven, Michael in Revelation 12 has to be Jesus, and this does not mean that he's a created angel. Number eight, the three stages of Christian history are stage one, the time of Jesus and the apostles. Stage two, the time of the Middle Ages and beyond. And stage three, the time of Earth's final conflict. Number nine, the times, 42 months, 1260 days, and a time, times, and half a time, they all refer to the same time period. Number 10, the day for a year principle should be considered with unusual numbers and when the situation requires it. Number 11, the serpent spewing water out of his mouth is an allusion to the serpent deceiving Eve in Genesis chapter 3. And number 12, Satan attacks God's people through persecution and through deception. Number 13, the children of the woman are God's end time people. 14, Revelation 12:17 sets the stage for the final conflict of Earth's history. By the time we're done here, we are actually going to, the last meeting, I'm going to put up on the screen a flow chart of the sequence of events that lead up to the second coming of Christ. It's fascinating. You know, step number one, two, three, four, the things that happen immediately before.
Thank you for joining Pastor Jeff Scoggins today for Worship in Spirit and Truth. We would love to hear your thoughts about the program, and your financial support is also greatly appreciated. so that we can continue bringing you these kinds of programs. Tell your friends they can find the program Spirit and Truth right here on this station. Stay tuned for contact information and more details from your local station to follow. Until next time, keep your mind fixed on Jesus.